ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 proudly present The Killer Bees.
Definitely a fan of The Killer Bees.
Don't sweat the technique.
Now from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, bringing you the fastest 3 hours in Houston sports radio, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Ooh, what up, H-Town? Hey, how we doing?
Diner hits one high. Ball game over.
He's Blank. I am Branham. It's B-Rod behind the glass. Hey, he's in for Brian. It is a Tuesday edition of the Killer Bees. Taco Tuesday edition of the Killer Bees. Yiner Diaz being the hero yesterday for the Astros after he was the GOAT in the previous at-bat. Another win for the Astros who, unlike the beginning of the year, Blankers, they find ways to win. They're just getting it done. They're finding ways to steal victories from the jaws of defeat.
Yeah, it was a phenomenal win that looked like, you know, they didn't lead until the walk-off home run. They were, you know, clawing, scratching, doing whatever they could, except for their defense, which was awful. But for the most part, this kind of erases another one of the games where early in the season you might say, that's one that I'm gonna hate and I'm going to remember for a while, or one that got away. This is one that I'm not going to say you stole it, but the fact that you were able to go and get it the way you did just builds more momentum. This team is red hot right now. You're right. They're finding ways to win, and it's exciting every single time they take the field. Doesn't matter what they get, what happens defensively, pitching-wise, hitting-wise, they're finding a way, and it's fun.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, like all of you Twitchers will have for the next 3 hours. A lot of takeaways from the game yesterday. I mean, Yiner's home run is obviously the lead story. Plays hero, again, continues to be one of the best offensive catchers in all of baseball, maybe the best offensive catcher in all of baseball for the last couple of months. The other day, he got robbed of a home run, and I sent the tweet at Jeremy Branham. I said that, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. And he hit the home run later in the game that just cleared every wall. It was the same thing here, because Yiner came up in the situation in his previous at-bat, you know, go-ahead run up, actually, just a tying run on base, a chance to take the, you know, to tie the game up, and Yiner had that pitch clock violation for strike three. Didn't like strike two, was unhappy with the call, took his time out, gets back in the box, and then takes another time out, which you can't do. Yiner had to know better in that situation, but then he atones for that specific spot and gets the redemption that he wanted. And hitting the walk-off home run. So it's like he screwed up in his previous at-bat, and then he gets the atonement hitting the walk-off home run, and then everybody's celebrating and everybody forgets about the time clock violation.
Now, what's weird is, did you see, I went back and watched it again this morning. Did you see him ever? I never saw the camera. Shin didn't have it. They went to a graphic, I think. So I wasn't sure if they did give him the first time out after he was upset with the inside low pitch.
Mm-hmm.
But that had to be what it was, right? Because there was 14 seconds on the pitch clock.
Yeah, I can math. So, yeah, he called the timeout. There was no way he didn't. Like, it wouldn't have been where it was if he didn't take the timeout. Like, yeah. He stepped out of the box. He was yelling at the umpire, and then he's back in, and there's 14 seconds. He took the timeout.
Okay.
It just wasn't caught on the broadcast.
Yeah, I didn't catch it on the broadcast. I mean, I can do math, too. I thought that they would make some kind of reference to it, and they seemed to be confused as well. But just the way it ended, too.
I think Blummer was the only one confused. TK was like, well, you probably called it earlier, and there's no argument from the dugout. I think Blum was the only one confused.
Okay. Then the fact that the little conversation with Yordan, kind of giving him the tip on the just the timing or whatever it was, that was fantastic. It doesn't always work out that way, but the fact on the very first pitch, he just absolutely annihilates it. He's on fire right now. He's doing everything you need him to do, especially with Tucker out. He's been picking up, and especially with teams that, unlike the Red Sox, who probably should with the way that Yordan has destroyed them, they're not really pitching around him. He had a big night, but then, you know, Yiner comes up in the big moment and shines yet again. The dude is just fun to – he's fun to watch, but he's doing more than what we saw earlier in the year and the things that we were talking about, runners in scoring position, you know, the ability to go the other way, not chasing as much. He's really in a groove right now.
Yeah, Jansen was blowing Yordan away with 92-mile-per-hour fastballs. I think it was very very much the timing thing. And then Yiner took heed to whatever Yordan had to say, and then he hits a blast immediately, the very first pitch that he sees. I think it was a timing thing. You could even see Yordan like do the – like kind of whenever the hand leaves the glove, kind of the extension there, the release. And Yiner had him timed up perfectly without ever seeing a pitch from him. So that was really cool.
Stroman sometimes does it. Montero used to do it sometimes where they and Nestor the Molester in New York would do it. Sometimes it's effective. It looks like it's gimmicky and you don't think that it would work. But yeah, Jansen's got that little hiccup sometimes where he pauses. And evidently, you're right. I mean, I wouldn't think 92 was getting by Yordan. But the fact of the matter was that whatever he said and whatever Yiner did was fantastic.
It wasn't a very good game that the Astros played either, I don't think. Four errors, first time they've done this in several years. Like, everybody was committing. You commit an error. You commit an error. Shea Whitcomb with an error leads to a run. Jeremy Pena makes a bobble. Jose Altuve gets credit for an error on a high throw that Yiner probably didn't have to leave the base for. It kind of shows his greenness over at first base. Lack of footwork again. We saw that the first time, too. And then Victor Caratini makes a bad throw. That prolongs an inning. The Astros defense was the worst it's been all year, yet you still win the game. So it's easier to, you know, kind of, you know, look at the not that they're watching film in baseball, maybe pitcher versus hitter, things like that. I doubt they watch film on their defensive miscues, but it's easier to swallow whenever you commit four errors in a game and then you win. Like, it's a much easier punishment to learn whenever you win the game and then you're trying to correct these defensive errors, but we don't ignore them. The defense wasn't very good yesterday.
No, it was awful, and I think that they mentioned that the last time they had four errors in a game, they actually won that game too. But yeah, you don't expect to win games like that when you're giving away runs, especially against a good team that's doing their best to try and stay in the playoff race as well. But you got their number, you got another win. Five in a row now that you've won against them, keep the momentum going now. Only one loss in their last 13 games, as they go into tonight. So yeah, it's not often that a team can kind of overcome four errors in a ball game, especially when runs are scoring on those errors. But yeah, a hell of an effort by them to come back and win it.
What'd you think of Kikuchi's performance yesterday?
I really thought it was good. I mean, we're talking about the errors. I mean, when you look at it, and overall, he gets to 100 pitches. He got more than five innings. He had some bad luck with the defense, but I'll take everything. The walks, you know, we had one walk. I'll take everything that he's given you yet again, because he's keeping you in ball games. He's better than what you had prior to the trade for him. And I think he's been a much better pitcher since he's been an Astro. I thought it was good.
What'd you think of the hook? I thought Kikuchi was good too. I thought the key inning was the fourth inning when he had runners at first and second, nobody out, gets a strikeout double play, keeps the deficit at two runs. I thought that was the critical point of that game. When you look at it from a Kikuchi perspective, I was pleased with how he pitched. I mean, of the three runs, only one was earned. You mentioned the walks. That's kind of a bugaboo for him at times. He had seven strikeouts, one walk, and 5 2/3. So yeah. I'll take that performance from Kikuchi. And his ERA with the Astros is under 2.5 in his four starts. And the Astros have won every single one of the starts that he has made. He's 2-0, but the Astros are 4-0 in his four starts. He's been very good, has been very impactful for the Astros in 2024. Certainly makes the Astros better as a team in 2024. The controversy was the hook. Pulling Kikuchi at 99 pitches, knowing that Yoshida would be a pinch hitter if you brought in a righty. Sure enough, he's the pinch hitter when you bring in a righty. I went back and watched the condensed game, and the Red Sox were like, what is Espada doing? Why in the world would he bring in a righty to face Yoshida, who's one of the hottest hitters in all of baseball? And he is. And Yoshida immediately hits a two-run home run that put the Red Sox in front 4-2. Broke the tie. So a lot of people are critical of Espada, especially Boston radio and Boston TV. The fact that Espada pulled Kikuchi at 99 pitches, 5 2/3, brought into everyday Tay, knowing that Alex Cora was going to bring in Yoshida, and then Yoshida made Espada's poor decision, if you believe that, pay immediately.
I was fine with it because he was, again, we know that he's been struggling to get into the, you know, more than five innings. And at 99 pitches, he's probably emptied the tank already. And if you've got Taylor Scott warming up, you know that he's been nails for you all season long. I'm never going to feel bad about bringing Taylor Scott into a game to get an out in that situation, regardless of who he's facing. So I had no problem with the move, no matter what anybody else might think.
I thought it was a poor decision. I'd rather have Kikuchi versus Connor Wong, go Cougs, who he had success against, rather than face the hottest hitter on the Red Sox. So I thought it was a bad decision by Espada. 99 pitches makes it kind of borderline because, like, you don't really want him to get to 100. He hasn't gotten through six innings in any of his four starts with the Astros. So I do concede that the pitch count was a concern, but I really don't want to face Yoshida in that spot. And bringing in a righty, you're going to face Yoshida in that spot. And then if you want to play the hindsight 2020 game, Yoshida homered
right
away off of Taylor Scott to break a 2-2 tie. I think the underrated guy yesterday was Josh Hader, quite frankly. We lose Hader in the shuffle a little bit in yesterday's game because of the Einar walk-off, because Kikuchi pitched in that game. But Hader came on, pitched in a non-safe situation, which at times this year has been his weakness. And Hader, 1-2-3, no issue at all on the top of the ninth, a stress-free top of the ninth inning. Josh Hader has not allowed a run since July 29th, 10 straight scoreless outings. 16 of his last 17 outings have been scoreless, and it put the Astros in a position where, okay, get a run, and let's go home and have a win.
I think the other thing that it put him in a position for that I kept watching was the fact that especially first pitch one out pop-up, but then he had, what, the 10-pitch second hitter before he got him out. But I'm looking at it going, if he can keep his pitches down, if they go into extra innings, I would think that this is another situation where he's considered he's going to consider trying to go to Hader another inning, and he could give you the 10th. To make sure that, you know, gives you your best chance with a runner on second base. It didn't come to that, but that was one of the things that crossed my mind was the fact that he's done it before. He's been effective. He could keep his pitches down. He might be able to do it again, but, you know, he ends up doing exactly what you need him to do and walks himself into a win.
Yeah, that was good to see Hader do that. The improbable run in the eighth inning stood out to me. Like, you get a leadoff man on. Jake Myers, why are you not laying down a bunt? Jake Myers, I think, is the worst runner-driver inner that has ever existed in Houston Astro history. Anytime that there's an RBI situation, Jake Myers is abysmal at driving in these runs. I thought he should have been bunting in that spot, even though you're down a run. But he hits into the double play. Two outs, nobody on. You're down a run. You have four outs left to play with. It doesn't seem good in that moment. And then Chaz McCormick, who entered the game earlier, gets an end-of-the-bat bloop single into shallow right, still second base. Mauricio Dubon, who's not been good in the summer, line drive into left field, scores the tying run. That might have been the most improbable sequence that we've seen in the month of August. Three things had to happen perfectly in a row. Chaz had to reach base, which, hitting below the Mendoza line, that has been a daunting task. Secondly, he had to steal second base. He's not a great base runner. I think a good throw might have got him. But he had to steal second base, the second of three perfect things that had to happen. And then Mauricio Dubon, who's had a bad couple of months, had to get a base hit. That was maybe the most improbable run that we've seen this entire month.
Yeah, nothing that you could have expected there. And the dugout, and they were talking about how everybody was celebrating just Chaz getting the flare just to get on base, let alone to set the table with the stolen base, and then Dubon coming in driving him. Sometimes when hot teams, you know, are riding the wave, everybody has to get involved. I mean, you mentioned Jake, to me, I cringe at any time he even has to bunt. I don't think he's a good bunter either, but he's horrible in those situations. And the double play is exactly what you didn't need. But the fact that those two guys in particular who have been really scuffling were the guys that stepped up to get you that run that tied the game was just a shot in the arm.
Yeah, that was improbable, to say the least. A spot of pinch-hitting Singleton for Cabbage in the sixth inning was big. Got the sacrifice fly. He didn't do that for Chaz the other day in the sixth inning, and I criticized him for that. So, hey, that's cool. He learned his lesson, perhaps, listening to the Killer Bees. And then Victor Caratini needs to play more. Victor Caratini should, not to say he's an everyday guy because he's a catcher. He's better as a lefty, they think, than a righty. But he reached four times yesterday, was 3-for-3 with a walk. Like, that guy should be playing almost every single day with this current lineup that you're running out each and every day.
And we talk about riding the hot hand, and whether it's we were talking about two, even as it relates to the outfield platoon of Earn the Burn, but the fact that he's earning the right to be in the lineup as much as you can possibly get him in there because of the fact that, yeah, he's a switch hitter and maybe he's not as good from the right side. But the bottom line is if he's getting on base four times, he's getting three hits for you. There's no reason to not have him somewhere in that lineup with the other options that you have. And he was huge.
Yeah. Anything that stood out to you?
I think that covers pretty much all of it to me. Everybody got a hit, including Chaz. The only guys that didn't were Jake and Cabbage.
Yeah, Jake is abysmal. Love his defense. He's been very bad offensively since like that hot June. What was it, June or was it May? I can't remember. I think it was June. I think it was a really hot June. And then he's been awful for the last 2 months. It might have even been May. It might have been a really hot May, and he's been bad June, July, and all of August. I can't quite remember. To me, he's a nine-hole hitter. I have no problem with him being an everyday guy. Like, I tweeted out yesterday he should be a nine-hole hitter, and people are like, oh, he shouldn't be on the team. Okay. Like, this offense isn't very good. Why not play your best defensive guy? Like, if you don't want to play him as much, I get that, but absolutely he should be your primary center fielder.
He has to be. I mean, when you look at just about how limited your options are across the outfield right now with Tuck out, The fact of the matter is he's the one guy, especially from a defensive perspective, that gives you what you need to cover a lot of ground in the outfield. You just have to take whatever he can give you offensively whenever he decides to contribute.
Yep. 713-780-ESPN. We'll take your thoughts on game one of the series yesterday for the Astros. We'll dive into some Texans, too. Cal McNair was doing an Ask Me Anything on Reddit. The best thing that Cal McNair had to say were the Texans in terms of the death. And we'll also talk to Larry Durker coming up at 4:15. Get his thoughts from the former skipper with where this Astro team is at. He was at the Hall of Fame weekend as well for the Houston Astros. 713-780-ESPN, HRMP listener line, 713-780-3776. We're on Twitch, twitch.tv/ESPN97.5, YouTube at ESPN Houston, Twitter at ESPN97.5. Blankers is Pac-Man Joel on Twitter. I'm at Jeremy Branham. We give a lot of credit to Murphy and Miller. We could do this all year. We have to have this conversation again. How can you possibly doubt the law firm / pitching coach that is Murphy and Miller? It's the Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Hey, before we go to break, a moment for the good people at MyBookie.ag. MyBookie.ag is the place that you need to be if you want to wager on sports, if you want to place casino games without flying to Vegas or driving to Louisiana. They are the answer for you, and they take care of you in so many ways. They love to take care of their customers to make sure that they're appreciated and they want to stay. And that's what they're doing yet again right now. They're doing a bonus for you when you sign up and put money into your account. All you have to do is when they ask for the promo code, put in bet975. It's what I always tell you to do. And you're going to cash in immediately, no matter what you put in your account. They're going to put more money on top of it, up to $1,000 based on what you put in. And you have more money in your account, more games you can bet on, and more chances you can win. And they've got all the sports and everything going on a continual basis. On the website, there's chats. There's ways that you can talk while doing in-game betting. And the fact of the matter is, even when there's not games going on and sports to bet on, there's always casino games available to you with live dealers standing by. You can play poker, you can play blackjack, and so much more. That's all I tell you to do is go to mybookie.ag and always use the promo code BET975. That's how you get that extra bonus. Check it out today, but always go there. It's the only place I tell you to go where you can bet anything, anytime, anywhere, and always where I tell you to do it. Mybookie.ag, promo code BET975.
ESPN 97.5. Coming to you live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, it's the Killer Bees
on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
Here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
It's the final week for Rock the Mic. We'll crown the winner of our 2024 podcast competition this Friday. Gallant and George and the Killer Bees broadcasting from noon until 7 at Carbach Brewery. That's right, extra hour of the show. Competition will be starting in the 5 o'clock hour. Plus, we are officially announcing that September 20th, a month from now, will be the 2024 listener party. If you come to Rock the Mic on Friday, you'll get early bird access to our VIP ticket. So we'll see you this Friday at Carbach. Cannot wait. All right, 713-780-3776. Astros lineup is out for today. No Bregman. Bregman's still out. Altuve, Yordan DH's, Yiner back in the three spot. Pena, Singleton, Dubon. Dubon earned that burn. So did Singleton, quite frankly. And then the bottom three, Myers, Whitcomb's back over there. And then Chaz McCormick, who found his smile. Chaz McCormick has found his smile, and he's in right field batting ninth for the Astros. Still don't really understand why Chaz McCormick plays right field and Dubon plays left field when Dubon has a far greater arm. And it's flip-flopped, like a spot of picks the ballpark. I imagine it's probably a ground they have to cover thing because there's less ground in left field at Minute Maid. There's more ground in right field, but you can kind of position the outfielders differently to overcompensate for that. But I imagine that's what it is, but it still triggers me. It's still something that bothers me. I like a strong arm in right. I don't like the noodle arm Chaz McCormick in left. And if they're both your corner outfielders, I would have Dubon in right field every single time.
Every time they do that and flip it, I just think noodle arm because of you always using that. And then the other thing that crossed my mind when one of the listeners said that they thought that he was thick, his running last night, I was watching him going, he wasn't as quick as he used to be in terms of it. He had a little piano on his back around at third base.
His sprint speed stuff, though, is it grades well.
Is that right?
And his range grades really well. Like, his range is as good as like as good as it's ever been. So, like, it doesn't add up whenever, like, you look at the advanced numbers. But, he, I mean, he does look a little – he's never been a great base runner, though.
Yeah, he looked like he was laboring coming around third.
He's not good at – like, he's not good at stealing bases. He's really not. Like, look at his career caught stealing stolen base, and it's not fantastic. He does – he's not a great base runner, but his speed is, like, high, and then his range is high. So I don't think there's an injury. But Chaz has found his smile back. He said after the game, he said – I haven't smiled in a while. It's good to feel that after he got a bloop single off the end of the bat. But, hey, improbable run, stole second base, and scored on the Dubon hit.
So. And essentially there he's admitting he's been pressing what we've seen. I mean, the body language and everything else, it's got to be tough when you know you're dipping under 200. Your team is red hot, and you're not contributing. But yet, due to injuries, they're forced to play you on a consistent basis. He was beating himself up mentally, and so maybe this gives him just a little bit of space where he can kind of settle in and try and just get comfortable.
Yeah. The law firm of Murphy and Miller, they get criticized quite a bit. And it's amazing what Yusei Kikuchi has done in his first four starts. I would have never imagined this, and I'll be the first one to admit that. Yusei Kikuchi in his first four starts has a 2.42 ERA. 2.42 ERA. Astros are 4-0 in those four starts. Yusei Kikuchi in his previous 12 starts with the Blue Jays had a 6.87 ERA. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not like a small sample. That is 12 starts. That's more than a third of the season. Starting pitchers, if you last the whole year, are going to make somewhere between 30 to 33 starts per year. He had the last 12 starts, he had a 6.87 ERA. In his last four, he's got a 2.42 with the Houston Astros. You can never doubt the law firm of Murphy and Miller. It's amazing what they're doing with Yusei Kikuchi. I think the two biggest benefactors that we've seen from the Astro tutelage over the years, and then Christian Javier was a huge benefactor of the Astros tutelage, was never a top prospect, never somebody who threw all that hard. Like, he didn't have an upper 90s fastball. He might be able to touch 94, 95 at his best. All he really had was another curveball, but they taught him, hey, live high in the zone, throw the curveball. We're going to keep hitters off balance. And he had a couple of really good years. And this year, I think the biggest benefactor of Murphy and Miller is Ronel Blanco. Ronel Blanco is in the top three in ERA in the American League. It blows me away what this Astros pitching coach staff have done with arms that have either struggled other places or arms that, quite frankly, weren't that highly decorated or thought of.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, when you start thinking about the Hunter Brown situation from early in the season to now, you mentioned Javier, you mentioned Blanco, Taylor Scott, a guy that was just basically signed as an arm to see what he has and just to see how effective he's been. And then it was almost like, you know, I'm the same way as you. I'll be the first to admit as well that when he had, you know, over his last 10 starts, he had a plus 7 ERA. And I'm going, it was almost like somebody said, hey, challenge time, hold my beer. Here's Kikuchi. See what you can do with him. I wasn't expecting anything near this. I was expecting better than Blas, so that at least you had a veteran at the back end of your rotation that might be able to hold water and do some things. The fact that he has done what he's done just is the icing on the cake for how good these two guys have been. I know that everybody, and rightfully so, loved to crown Strami and you know, always makes mention of Strami. But there was a bunch of Astros fans that were clamoring to get rid of Miller and Murphy early in the season because they were putting the struggles of this team on their shoulders. Now, in retrospect, when you look back and see the success stories, it's hard not to give them their flowers.
The Astros were dead last in ERA for a couple of months. It was nothing to do with Murphy and Miller. It had everything to do with throwing guys that weren't big leaguers, the amount of guys you were using, struggles from guys that you're now counting on. Hunter Brown was abysmal in the first couple of months of the year to the point where, like, hey, he probably needs to go down to Sugarland to work on his craft. And he went all the way from needing a demotion to now suddenly one of the best pitchers in all of baseball. Framber Valdez has kind of reinvented himself again, too. Like, Framber has always been a guy with great stuff, finished top five a few years ago, threw that curveball a lot, and then kind of started to venture away from the curveball, I think because he has trouble commanding it, and he was trying to work on his command. And now it's like, hey, why don't we add that to a weapon again when you're ahead of count so you can get more swing and miss? And he is getting tons of swing and miss. It's pretty incredible what they do.
And I think you'd agree with me. Throw Arrighetti in there as well, because when Arrighetti got called up, Arrighetti wasn't pitching the way he's pitching now. Arrighetti had to figure some things out, and whether it's when to use what pitches in terms of his sequencing and things like that. But as he settled in, those guys worked with him, and you could see a complete transformation in Arrighetti as well.
Yeah. They And it seems simple, and we've talked about this too, like with Kikuchi, where it's okay, he doesn't throw the curveball, doesn't have good success. The Astros are going to limit his usage with the curveball. His changeup has better success than the amount that he's actually throwing it. Why don't we start throwing that more? So they do a lot of the keep it simple, stupid stuff, but then on top of that, stuff that we probably don't see is, okay, how are we going to attack hitters? Like, how are we going to figure out the weakness of a guy, how we want to attack, the sequencing of what they do? Because the sequencing is one of the most important things. Like, what is the oldest adage in baseball when it comes to a pitcher? Keep the hitter off balance. How do you keep a hitter off balance? With elite sequencing. You have really good sequencing, your hitter is going to be off balance. All of a sudden, it's a fastball that's 93 at the top of the zone. Good sequencing, it looks like it's 96, 97. We saw it a little bit with Jordan yesterday, more of the timing than sequencing, though. But it was off balance. Jordan was off balance, and he's late on 92-mile-per-hour heaters, which he's never late at 92-mile-per-hour heaters. So I think that like what we do see in the obvious, they're really good at eliminate bad pitches, throw more of the good pitches. But then on top of that is we're going to be really good at sequencing and we're going to be really good at attacking hitters' weaknesses because they do have a long history. And even with Strom, I think it's an organizational philosophy that predates Strom. It's just taught to everybody that coaches pitching in their organization. You know, you saw it with Gerrit Cole. You saw it with Charlie Morton. I mean, Justin Verlander was not having a great year whenever he came here. You've had some veterans who've had their best years in Houston, the names that we mentioned. So this organization is really good, great, maybe elite at getting the most out of pitchers.
And I think you and I have talked about it throughout the year, too. When you think about and go pitcher by pitcher, it's different with different pitchers. And like you mentioned, Kikuchi, they knew that he had big league pitches that were above average, but they also knew that he had a tendency to leave fastballs and pitches right in the middle of the plate when he missed, and his curveball was a problem, and they fixed that. You talk about Arrighetti and the fact that he started to command the inside part of the plate, use his fastball a little bit more, and he had his success. Hunter Brown with the two-seamer and the fact that he also was commanding the inside part of the plate. You know, Blanco only threw his changeup, I think, like 7% last year, and all of a sudden the changeup became an outpitch for him that made him much more effective, and you can go on and on. I even think Seth Martinez was a guy that went from mop-up to a guy you could really count on because they did the same thing with him. And it's the amount of detail they put into, yes, it's the analytics and the spin and a lot of that kind of stuff, but it's also, like you said, getting down into marrying the lineup that you're facing with the pitches that you offer and then never being the same in terms of the sequencing from the first, second, and third times you see it. First time, if you're using, you know, primarily a lot of changeup, then mix it up the second time around and either go to the curveball or go to the fastball. But it's working, and you can't turn the other cheek and say, yeah, it's just the pitchers themselves and their ability. No, it's these guys doing what they need to do, doing their jobs well, so that these guys can be the best they can be.
713-780-ESPN, HRMP listener line, 713-780-3776. Let's get to the best of Cal McNair's Ask Me Anything on Reddit, because he's a cool cat these days. It's the Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. You need a goal from ProDunk Hoops. School is back in session, so you need the kids out in the driveway, in the front yard, shooting some hoops whenever they get home from school for a couple of reasons. Allow them to, you know, get the stress off their mind after a long day, and then get them out of your hair as you're making dinner or whatever you're doing. Get a goal from ProDunk. They have the highest quality basketball goals you'll find. Tempered glass backboard, breakaway rims, stainless steel hardware, height adjustable. They have the highest quality basketball goals you'll find, unlike anything you'll find in the big box stores. And all of those things gives you that true, authentic feel whenever you see these goals in the pro gyms or the college gyms. And we mentioned it's height adjustable, didn't we? 5 feet to 10 feet, anywhere in between. And their new goal 4, you can raise and lower the goal with a drill. It's their lightning adjust feature, anywhere from 5 feet to 10 feet in a matter of seconds. Their accessories are great, too. LED light kits for night play. Kids are in school, might not be able to play until the evening. Probably want to wait until the sun goes down anyways because it's hot in Houston. Well, get LED light kits so you can play at night. Backstop nets. You don't have to waste your time chasing after the basketball, pull pad lettering, and lots, lots more. You can order everything online, including professional installation. That's right. It's idiot-proof. You're not going to screw it up because you're going to get the pros to do it for you. The pros at ProDunk will install your goal perfect height, perfectly straight. You don't have to lift a finger. Let the pros at ProDunk do the installation for you. Give them a call right now at 281-351-9822, 281-351-9822, and visit ProDunk.com. That's ProDunk.com.
You're listening to ESPN 97.5. Coming to you live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, it's the Killer Bees
on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
Here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Cody on Twitter, not taking away from anything you are saying, completely agree, but I wonder how big of a the culture is part of this, the expectation of winning, knowing Jose's in the dugout trying to get to another ALCS, et cetera, et cetera. I never gave much weight to that. Maybe the expectation of winning, coming into a good clubhouse, a good culture, I think that probably carries some weight. I don't know if I'm going to put more weight in that than elite, like, pitching tactics and pitching strategy, though. Like, I mean, Kikuchi's a really good example of it because we just rattled off the 12 previous starts. We had a 650 ERA. Last four starts, he's got under a 250 ERA. And it's like, well, what's changed? Like, and people were, well, it's mechanics. No, that's too quick. That's too quick to be tinkering with your right. mechanics. They might have done, like, one tinker, but it's more about pitch usage and it's about pitch sequencing. That's the difference between Kikuchi with the Astros and Kikuchi with the Blue Jays. And it's more than just, like, hey, this pitch is good, throw this a lot. Hey, this pitch is bad, eliminate. They do that, but it's also the sequencing. It's also how they're attacking their hitters. I would say that the culture in the clubhouse matters. I just don't think it compares to getting the tutelage of what the Astros are instructing their pitchers to do.
I think there's two different things. I think there's a standard when a guy goes into that locker room and realizes, hey, there's an expectation that we're going to win. There's an expectation of how you're going to carry yourself and go about your business. When it comes down to your craft itself, I could see when they mentioned Verlander working with Hunter Brown a little bit, or a veteran being able to kind of suggest something here and there. But your coaches are the ones that are watching every pitch, literally charting everything that you do and the spin that it has and where the pitches went. And they're the ones that are going to be the first ones that do your bullpen sessions, that work with you in between, that show you the video. So, no, I think it's two different things. I think there is something to the culture in that locker room as it relates to these guys, the changes they've made, the success they had. I don't think it's nearly where a veteran is able to make a difference. I think it's the two guys that are literally working with every guy in that staff.
Yeah, and it predates them too, because obviously Brent Strom had it, but I think that's part of the organizational development. They picked it up from Strom. Strom picked it up from what he was being taught whenever he came here too. It's just an organizational thing. I mean, Strom even mentioned whenever he left, he's like, well, all these new guys are really Murphy and Millers anyways, so they're not going to miss a beat. And they didn't. Astros led the league in ERA the first year of Murphy and Miller. They went backwards a bit since then. They had a bad 2 months at the start of this year, and they've been on fire since.
You know, the other thing too, Jeremy, is everybody that comes in, and Kikuchi was, and even Ferguson were the two guys that Espada mentioned, hey, if they trust us, if they allow us and listen to us to give them the suggestions and they implement them, we're confident that they're going to have success. Because you can sit there and know what you think a pitcher needs to do, change, work on, but if they're not willing to listen to you and they're set in their ways, especially veterans, then you're not going to have any chance of getting the results that you need. But because they were open to the suggestions, Kikuchi is reaping the benefits. At least Ferguson had a 1-2-3 inning last night. But you have to be open to it in order to get to the point where a lot of these guys got to.
Yeah, it's going to you have to be coachable. There's no doubt. You have to be coachable. 2180, I think there's something to that last texter. Every non-Astro pitcher is a loser until they come to Houston. Become losers again when they leave, unless named Greinke and Morton. I mean, Gerrit Cole was really good when he left the Astros. This year he hasn't been good because he's hurt. Space City Kev, being a lead at that pitching strategy on the coaching level is one of the things that led this team to be a winner, which is how you can have the expectation of winning so no one feeds the other and the others and ones that expect is there and it's in the culture. It's huge. I do think that there is the momentum aspect of it too. 3109, Singh, around the league, teams know that the Astros can change an average pitcher to a top-tier pitcher. Does that quality become a disadvantage when it comes down to the trade deadline? Do you think the Astros will always get fleeced by other teams at the trade deadline when trading for a pitcher? No. I mean, trading for a pitcher is tough because they're expensive. Doing it at the deadline when there's a premium price on it is tough because they're expensive. I think that they could be a little bit better at maybe signing some bargain guys in free agency so that maybe they're not as desperate at the trade deadline. But they also just got crushed in the injury department at starting pitcher. So yeah, it's hard to put a whole lot of blame on them.
And it is. And every year situationally is different. I mean, you mentioned the injuries. If you're working with injuries or guys that suddenly are struggling that you've relied on in the past, even in this case, a Montero, and suddenly you're looking, you know, everybody knows and the writing's on the wall for what you're desperate for, what you're looking for. And in this case, in this scenario leading up to the deadline, we knew that the premium was pitching and the price was going to be hefty if you were going to be, you know, in the competition for one or more pitchers, starter or reliever. And we saw that play out. That's not the same, say that it's going to be the same thing every year. And we know that the changes and needs of every team year to year are going to vary. But you're right. The combination of the injuries, some of the guys that were less than, and the fact that they were desperate to get back into this race, there was a lot of things happening in a short period of time where they had to pay a very high premium.
Yeah. Cal McNair was doing it, Ask Me Anything on Reddit yesterday. His reputation, much different than where it's been like 2 years ago. And again, I was first on it. Everybody wanted to call him a buffoon, a doofus. No, he's cool cat Cal McNair. And look, me being an influencer, now everybody believes that Cal McNair is a cool guy. He was on the Ask Me Anything yesterday. Some of the things that his favorite dinosaur is a T-Rex, which, you know, that's a cool dinosaur. What's your favorite dinosaur?
I would go that route.
Of any dinosaur that you look the most like, what would it be?
Probably T-Rex.
T-Rex? Yeah, I don't really know enough about dinosaurs. I don't know what they're
called.
Got
a big melon, and he's you know.
They have short arms. Yeah, they're athletic.
They're one of the most powerful, I mean, and biggest dinosaurs. I don't know. I know. Pterodactyl.
You don't eat a whole lot of red meat, though. We have to go, what are they called? The ones that don't eat meat? I forget what they're called. They're called something.
There's a dinosaur that doesn't.
There's a lot of, yeah, there's a lot of plant-eating
vegan
dinosaurs.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think like half of them are only plant-eating.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know. I wasn't around. Hannah McNair crashed the party. Someone asked if Slowick missed a game, could Hannah McNair fill in, and she said she would blitz all day, in which Cal McNair said he calls the offense,
yeah,
babe.
Exactly.
it's starting to feel a little bit orchestrated, though. Like, it's starting to feel very scripted. Like, I'm kind of seeing through. I like Cal McNair. I like the turnaround of Cal McNair. Hannah McNair has been instrumental in the turnaround of Cal McNair, I believe, and getting rid of Jack Easterby, I believe. But a lot of this is pretty scripted that we're starting to see.
I don't think it's just coincidental or just now. I think I've seen a lot of it, but to their credit, as an organization, whoever's helping them, however they've gone about this, it has been a stroke of genius the way they've handled everything. Because to your point, not everybody thinks that he's cool cat Cal. Now, I still think he is exactly who he is. He just has buffers, and Hannah should be the real unsung hero that gets a ton of credit, because once she got in the picture started to change. And she has been such a huge positive from the fan base to the things that they're actually doing. And I think the combination together has made them more lovable from the fan base's perspective, too, and kind of helped it to kind of accelerate the process of turning it around. But look, Cal plays his part really well. She does, too. She interrupts when she has to or when she wants to.
Is it getting to the point where it's a little cringe, though?
Oh, yeah.
I think so, too.
I think it's already been there.
I think it's a little cringe. Yeah. But, like, it's okay. It can be cringe, though, because they're good and because they're winning. Like, you can kind of do whatever whenever you're winning. It's forgivable when you're winning. If the Texans disappointed and went like 4-13 this year and they're still doing that thing, I think people are going to start pointing out the cringe a little bit more.
Well, you mentioned it. It's like the wrestling open that they did.
Mm-hmm.
That's great when you're winning, but that gets really corny and attacked in a hurry if you're a losing franchise and you're doing it. But also the fact that they've been willing to own it as their shtick. It works for now, but how long is it going to go before people tire of it? If you keep winning, yeah, they'll take whatever you're throwing out there.
You can do it forever. And really, if you spend, too, like if you're willing to spend and open up the checkbook and kind of get it out of the way, I think you can kind of be forgiven, too. I'll take the cringe over the guy that's, like, you know, dying on the hill for Jack Easterby, though.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I think the other thing, too, Jeremy, is that they're not going to take the negativity if something would go wrong. Because they're not the Dan Snyders and the Jerry Jones, and I got my hand in the cookie jar and I'm dealing with everything on the football side. When things go wrong on, like, football side of things and personnel things, it's just going to be Nick Caserio, D'Amico, whatever. Whereas when you get these other owners that want to meddle too much, that's when people start getting a lot of negativity towards ownership.
Yeah. Herbivore is the word I was looking for. Herbivore only eats plants. Carnivores eat the meat. There's a lot of herbivore dinosaurs. This texter said, what is an herbivore? That would be, what is a herbivore? He said, come on, man. I tell you this all the time. I am not smart. I don't know why you guys think that I'm smart. I really don't understand.
When did we study dinosaurs in grade school? I used to have some of the little plastic dinosaurs and
I don't
stuff
even,
when we
probably.
Yeah, but I mean, and I might be able to name five back then. I don't think I can name more than a couple now.
Yeah, but I'm not even looking for excuses. I'm just dumb. Like, I don't know what the listeners expect of me. I am not a smart person. I've told you this forever, and I prove this time and time again. I prove this every single day. I did watch A Land Before Time when I was young. I think it was Littlefoot. Remember that?
Yeah. Yeah, and then, what was it? There was way before your time, but was it The Land of the Lost? Was the dinosaur kid show?
I don't remember that one.
Yeah, but I could, you know, what is it? Pterodactyl, Tyrannosaurus Rex, Triceratops? I think that's where I end.
Branham Kid could tell you every single dinosaur that's ever existed.
Is that right?
Yeah, he would sweep us off our feet when it comes to this. All right, 713-780-3776. Is Kyle McNair cringe? What do you think of him being on the Ask Me Anything on Reddit? Also, when we return, is the Texans' depth good enough? 713-780-3776. It's the Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Guys, before we go to the break, a word from a good friend, Doc Linville. Doc Linville, best in the business at helping you get your hair back, and it's literally your hair. It's not the sprays and the creams and the foams that mask the problem. It's actually your hair taking from a place where you're never going to lose it, and he explained it to me. Genetically, you never lose the hair on the sides and the back of your head, no matter how bald you go in other places. And he can take some of that, repurpose it, put it where you need it most. The NeoGraft is that procedure. And in no time at all, you have your hair back. It's the same color. It grows in the same direction. Everything falls into place literally. And you have a better appearance, more self-confidence. And it's going to stay with you for a lifetime because he's taking it from a place where it's never going to go away. You could have a bald spot up on top and back. You could have a hairline that's sadly going up and up and up by the day. And he can fix it. That's the biggest thing. And the other big thing is, because you listen to us and you're interested in what he has to offer and to see if it might be right for you, you can go to 975hair.com and get a free consultation with Doc and his staff. It normally costs $150 if you just are walking in off the street. But if you go to 975hair.com and set up the appointment, they're going to take care of you with a free consultation. They'll explain to you what PRP is. It's like fertilizing your lawn. There's hair there. It's just, it needs to be thicker and stronger. The PRP can do that. You've heard about it with athletes using it for their elbows and their knees and such. You can do it with hair too, and they can explain to you how. And the NeoGraft procedure. If it's just already gone, there's no hair left, and you want to get hair back, the NeoGraft is the way to do it. And because you're listening to us and you go to them, no obligation, no signing on the dotted line, no fees that you have to pay, just a question and answer session after they explain the two procedures, and you can decide for yourself if it's right for you. It was right for me. It was right for so many others. You could be next in line. Tell them I sent you by. Go to 975hair.com.
ESPN 97.5.
It's the final week for Rock the Mic. We're crowning our champion this Friday at Carbach Brewery.
The winner is...
Come join Gallant, George, and the Killer Bees as they broadcast live from noon to 7 for this special event. Besides watching the finalists duke it out to be our Rock the Mic champion, if you come out Friday to Carbach Brewery, you will get early bird access to our VIP tickets for the ESPN 97.5-92.5 2024 Listener Party. So see you Friday at Carbach Brewery.
Got what it takes to rock the mic right.
You're locked in with the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
713-780-ESPN, HRMP listener line. The word cringe is cringe. Yeah, I can see that. Land Before Time, only real ball knowers are familiar. I agree. That was Land Before Time was awesome.
Okay.
Great show. Wheat straw dinosaurs feel different to me, nor that we know think they had feathers instead of scales. Okay, this is getting a little bit too, this is getting a little too deep here. 2753, also let Cal cook. Yeah, let Cal McNair cook. Let him cook by getting out of the way and letting the football people make the football decisions. Let Nick Caserio handle the roster. Let D'Amico handle the coaching, and Cal McNair can worry about his image. Yes, let's let Cal cook. I agree.
Yeah, no, let him keep flipping burgers and dogs and doing what he needs to do to keep the peeps full and happy at and around practices, and let the football guys do what they're paid to do. And the fact that we don't know what we don't know about how it all went down when they got Will Anderson and C.J. Stroud and who said what and how many people were involved, but at the end of the day, if they said their piece and stayed out of it and let those guys get those two guys too, then keep going with that system.
What do you think of the Texans' depth? Can they survive critical injuries? I mean, obviously, if C.J. Stroud goes down, they're doomed. Like every NFL team that loses a starter outside of Nick Foles, they're doomed. But what about other positions? Is the Texans' depth good enough?
Yeah, the thing that I was thinking about in all of this was the fact that even when you have impact players, a lot of times, like a Parsons in Dallas, if you lose him on defense, their defense is in shambles. When you think about losing Autry for the first six games, and you still have pass rushers across the board, and it's not just going to be Hunter and Will Anderson Jr., but you've got guys that showed that even from a Jerry Hughes that seems like he's on the back nine of his career, he's found something enough to be able to be effective. That I was thinking about, aside from CJ, because everybody knows if you lose the quarterback, you're pretty much probably done, no matter who your backup is. But have they created enough depth and talent that we didn't see in years past to where even if there was a guy on either side of the football that you lost, that they're going to be okay. And the first thing that came to mind was you lose Autry. But who are the guys that are going to be that impactful? The only guys that really came to my mind, first and foremost, was Laremy Tunsil. Because if you lose Laremy Tunsil, now left tackle is such a valuable position that if you don't have Laremy Tunsil, no matter who you try and fill those shoes with, no matter what, whether it's your first-round pick or anybody else that you're looking at, I just don't know. Is it Fisher? Was he second round pick? Yeah. I don't think that's the one guy that came to mind that he would be so hard to replace is Laremy Tunsil. But and Stingley might be on the other side. But when you think about it, there are some guys that you're a little cringeworthy if you lose. But unlike years past, this team has so much more depth. We even went with it with the offensive line last year with the guys they lost, and they had to scramble before the season and try to pick up some veterans, where I think that they've created a lot of depth right now, which should be appreciated too in the fact that they're not going to be hopefully in that same situation no matter what happens with injuries.
Yeah, I mean, depth at running back, probably not there, but can you survive without it? Probably. Receiving has plenty of depth. I think tight end has depth. Could you miss a few games with Dalton Schultz? I think so. I think you could live with a few games without Dalton Schultz. Tunsil, I'm with you. I like Fisher. He's not ready to fill in for Laremy Tunsil. Now, if it was right tackle, I think you're fine. Mm-hmm. I think you can survive a couple of games with the interior offensive line. Like, you don't want Kenyon Juice and Shaq Mason to get hurt. But the guys that are backing him up played a lot of snaps last year. Kendrick Green played a lot of snaps. Jared Patterson played a lot of snaps. So I think you could survive that. Defensively, even if like an Anderson or a Hunter went down for a little bit, well, you still have one of them. You're going to get Foley back after 6 weeks. So like at least you have reinforcements on the way. Defensive tackle, I think, is kind of – I mean, you have your top guys, Foley, probably Edwards, but you have some guys that can fill in there. I would point to Stingley. I would point to Stingley like you did. I think you would have a significant drop off from Stingley, and it's not so much that like Lassiter would be the next guy up. It's more that if Stingley gets hurt, now you're having to play like a Cooter or Henderson,
right.
And the drop off from Stingley to a Cooter or Henderson is pretty great. So Stingley would be at the top of my list. I think you can survive everywhere else.
I got
linebacker
one for you.
Is pretty weak.
Yeah, I was going to say. So you said the two sleepers for me, because I think the ones where it's just most significant would be Stingley and or Laremy Tunsil, but the two sleepers to me, if anything happens to Mixon, your depth at running back is not great, and the guys that you need to do at least something like Joe Mixon can do it, I don't think, with the exception of maybe Cam Akers, but with the injuries, I don't know how much you can use him to be an every down back. And linebacker's the other one to me. If something happens to El Shaair, I'm like, boy, they need some depth at linebacker, because if he goes down, with as much as they're relying on him to be the quarterback of that defense, be the run stopper, be all over the field, I think that they could look to add some depth at linebacker.
Yeah, the linebacker is something that is a little bit worrisome, especially with the current state of Christian Harris.
Yeah,
with Harris being as banged up as he has, and he hasn't really practiced. Like he got back out on the field and then immediately was like limping off the field before he did anything of consequence. That's the linebacker spot's where I'm more worried about the linebacker spot than any other spot.
Yeah, I think linebacker to me and running back were the two that I think kind of get overlooked when you think about how impactful Stingley and everybody talking about how great he can be and taking it to another level this year, and how valuable Tunsil's been as being one of the best left tackles in the game. But you just have – you got two guys in this offseason that you are relying so heavily on that I don't think enough has been put into just – in the rare case, but on the what-ifs, if something happens to one or both of those guys – that could greatly alter what you do on both sides of the football.
Yeah. 713-780-ESPN, HRP listener line. Have you watched the Steve McNair documentary? It's good. I've not watched that yet. I did listen to a podcast, The Fall of a Titan, a few years ago that I imagine is very, very similar. That I really enjoyed, so I probably will watch it. 8341, I think the depth that would be hard. The most over injuries will be the offensive line. They work so close together. Defense, you're kind of out there on an island by yourself. You work together with the schemes and all, but man, your offensive line, if you take a couple of injuries, it's going to be tough. I think especially if it's a key guy. Like, I would have Laremy Tunsil high on that list. Laremy to Fisher is a huge drop-off. I don't think Titus Howard to Fisher is that significant, though. I think Titus is a better football player right now, but could you survive 3 weeks if Blake Fisher's your right tackle instead of Titus Howard? I think so. I think the next highest guy on the offensive line that I wouldn't want to lose is Shaq Mason, because he's just the veteran in the room. Like Kendrick Green, if he had to play it instead of Kenyon Green, is it a drop-off? Sure, but is it significant? I think it's moderate. I wouldn't say it's that substantial as going from Shaq Mason to somebody else. I think Patterson can fill in a pinch. So I would say Laremy Tunsil, the most important on the offensive line. I would actually say Shaq Mason, number two. Mm-hmm. And then after that, maybe Juice because he's your center. And then Kenyon Green, Titus Howard might be a toss-up. I don't want to not say Titus Howard because people think I'm biased.
At least with Juice, if he goes down, you got Patterson to back him up. I think the scary thing would be if you're relying heavily right now on Kenyon Green, and Kenyon Green again falls short or gets another season-ending type injury, that could really screw everything up too with the continuity of the line.
Yeah. All right, 713-780-ESPN, HRP listener line, 713-780-3776. I'm tired of hearing this narrative about the Chiefs, that they have this ability to flip the switch. We'll discuss it when we come back. It's the Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
ESPN 97.5.